Thanks, everybody. I'm sorry we're starting a little bit late. I take all the blame for that, and it's not none of our speakers, but so I'm sorry for that. We're really very fortunate to have this very interesting panel looking at new models of private sector development with a particular focus on the role of emerging donors, emerging actors. There's some funniness about what we call these folks. There's some sensitivity, but in essence, think of it as the BRICS plus. And so I think we're going to hear from a number of different perspectives. Let me provide a little bit of context and go back about 5 or 6 years ago when I was at AID working with Kurt Reinsma, who's one of my friends and mentors in development. Sigrid Kaag, who's here, we have a number of you all have the biographies of the folks who are going to be speaking in front of you, but Sigrid Kaag is the Assistant Secretary General at UNDP, and the person who had Sigrid's job before Sigrid was Bruce Jenks. And Bruce, with a gentleman named Saba Sobhani, who's here, said, look, we've got this idea of about looking at the role of the private sector in development. And this is around mid-2005. And, you know, we've got the French government, we've got the Global South-South cooperation folks, and we've got the UNDP talking about the role of the private sector in development. So we'd like the Americans to chip in some money. And I thought to myself, okay, so we're not really in a great place with the French right now, and this is wearing my Bush administration hat, and we'd like to do some constructive things with the UN, and I know that the UN is sort of like the papacy of international development. So if they provide the imprimatur saying that private sector development is good, and they have a way of reaching folks and are more credible messenger than the Americans are. So why the heck wouldn't we do something like this? Well, you know, getting money for multilateral institutions, if you've ever been in the U.S. government, is pretty gosh darn hard. And they'll say, why are you writing checks to multilateral institutions when you're supposed to be doing this bilaterally? What was, in my mind, a no-brainer, and we found a small amount of money so that we could say we're doing this with the French and the UN and the Global South folks at a time when perhaps it was a little bit where we thought there was some PR bennies for doing this as well as it was the right thing to do. And the report that came out was something called Creating Value for All, which there are copies outside. And I think it was part of an initiative that's now called Growing Inclusive Markets. So putting aside sort of my prosaic or calculating interests into what went into this, putting that aside, it sort of dilutes in the mists of time, you have something that I think has caused a real revolution in development, because having the UN say that the private sector-led development is important, it's not as if it's something new, but having them say this actually means something, because the UN can reach folks that other people can't. There have been a whole series of things that have come about as a result of the UNDP launching this initiative. Really, this report came out in 2008, but this has been a sort of ongoing since 2005. And a series of things have spun off as a result of that, and I think you'll hear about some of them. That's my long way of introducing this topic in terms of why I was so excited when Sigrid Kaag was coming to town, because I knew I was aware of the context, and I had been one of the protagonists in helping getting this started, and so I was pleased to host this. But before I ask Sigrid to make some remarks, I just want to also recognize Hong Seok In, who's here from the Korean Embassy, who's one of the asks of our friends at UN was to say, you know, we'd like to have someone who's an emerging donor come and speak to the issue about how new donors, if you will, are thinking about development issues, because I think one of the messages we want to get across here is that depending on who you talk to, newer development actors bring their experiences to the table, their own perspectives to development, and that there are some advantages and opportunities for all of us in terms of thinking about that. And I know Kurt Reinsma, who is here, who leads the Office of Donor Coordination at USAID, spends part of his role is to help work with these emerging donors and partner with them on a number of different issues. And obviously one piece of that is the private sector development agenda, sometimes in triangular cooperation, but there's a series of other ways in which we have cooperation interests with these countries. And I know that Kurt will speak to that within the context of this conversation. So I won't speak any further, and I'm going to hand the floor over to Sigrid, and then I'll ask to hear from Kurt and then from Mr. Seok in from the embassy. So Sigrid, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Thank you again, Dan, and thank you very much for coming. I'm delighted to be here. I'll focus my remarks maybe on just four themes. One of them is a brief description of what I think is the change. It's not changing, but really the changes that Dan has already referenced. What is the opportunity when you look at development cooperation? What are perspectives, and really what is UNDP's approach? I'll try not to talk too much about what we do. I think some of the books and the literature you have, and also our website, but I'd really like to use this opportunity for dialogue on what's really happening and how we can all, individually and collectively and institutionally, can play a role. Now, I think the change, what is the change? And I want to place this also in a context of the challenges this poses for multilateral development institutions, be it the UN, UNDP, or entities such as the World Bank. The change is really, as you know, is that the entire geopolitical and multilateral landscape has changed phenomenally. We often still speak of emerging partners, emerging donors, but I think we fail to recognize that they've arrived. The OECD DAC membership has changed. I mean, Chile joined recently. Israel's joined. A number of other countries have. So the change has happened. The discussion also in Paris is equally important with a Brazil nowadays, an India, a China, but not from a perspective of donorship. These countries don't want to come to the table to talk about that. They come to be partners on the development debate and want to influence policies, but it's a situation of equals and potentially more than equals because it's a reflection of the changes, and we see that not only financially, we see it politically, we see it also in the cross-regional collaboration that takes place. This obviously has led to a lot of debate on what the new development paradigm is. And this is not only the progress we're making, despite some lags in fragile states on the MDGs, but also the discussions on what the post-2015 MDG or the framework should be. And all of you who follow the discussions in the run-up to the Rio Plus 20 conference, we know it's about sustainable development, the inclusion of social, economic, and the environmental pillars. Irrespective of where your political viewpoints are, your expectations of Rio, we know that sustainable human development is critical, and the choices how we're going to get there obviously will be impacting us. And all that has ramifications for the development system, be it you're a bilateral actor, such as a country, a donor, or a multilateral system partner, which really implements on behalf of and works with program countries. Now, this has also led, all these changes obviously are being felt in what we call the development architecture. The development architecture traditionally in the post-Second World War era, one really of a firm multilateral system and the bilaterals that act. Cold War, post-Cold War. But all these changes have taken tremendous shape. I mean, the voice of Bill Gates alone, the Gates Foundation, Bill Gates, when he speaks on behalf of WHO's financial crisis, who would have considered this? Who would have imagined that you have a billionaire, philanthropist as well, a man with a vision, but fundraised for the World Health Organization, which is really member state owned? All these pictures are signs of times, of rapidly changing times. CEOs of foundations, private sector individuals that commit to the global compact. The CEO of Unilever, for instance, to name one example, is a strong partner with the Secretary General on a new partnership facility. I'm naming these as examples because it's a very different world we live in, and we are just one of the players. Sometimes it's tough also for people like me to accept that, oh, I thought I was sort of, we're in the big league. We're in a very important league, but we're not the only league, and we're not the only player. At the same time, that is tremendously healthy for anyone. Competition is good, comparison is good, and the challenge to say, where is my value add, where is my comparative advantage as a UN system partner, where is my legitimacy? Of course, we have it as the UN in terms of the norms and the standards and the principles and the charter, but we also need to continuously prove our relevance through performance, through innovation, and through new ideas. Now, this is, of course, also where the opportunity comes in and the partnerships. That is one of our ability to break out of the traditional way of working and looking where the development providers of today, including China, Brazil, South Africa, India, Russia, you name them, where they see the policy remit. What do they want to contribute to development progress? How do they see the MDGs? Where do they fit in the discussion on sustainable development goals? Because that soon is emerging. But also, how can we look at the models that they have long established, but which we probably insufficiently acknowledge, the models of South-South cooperation. I may give as an example that, for instance, countries in Latin America have long collaborated amongst one another, have provided technical services, technical assistance, doctors, social workers, you name them. Countries sent them to Africa. Within Africa, Morocco has long been a service provider and a development provider to the neighboring countries in Africa of a poorer economic statute. We forget about that. The same trilateral cooperation. So what we find now in this new landscape, that traditional donors are looking to partner with Brazil to work together in Angola. We see that Denmark is looking to work with Korea in Asia. And there are tons and tons of examples with a lot of learning to be done and a lot of testing, of course, as well. I'm not saying that the fact that it's happening means everything is successful, and the fact that it's happening that it is coherent and that it actually makes a difference. That we cannot always say, because obviously the risk of multitude of choices also may imply the risk of fragmentation, both of the way we are used to working, and we need to make sure that we are complementary, that we work towards priorities and remain very respectful of country and national ownership of what the development priorities are. So this is both the change, it's the opportunity. Now, how do we work within that when we're also going to the lens and the topic of the theme today in terms of the public-private partnerships? One of them is that UNDP itself has said we have a certain way of working. We know we are legitimate at country level. We work across the globe. We are the UN. We stand for certain norms and values, and we have tremendous development experience. And the majority of our staff are nationals of these countries. It's a form of capacity building in its own right, but more importantly, we are in tune with what the development needs are because we are there all the time and working across the board. We also feel we derive our legitimacy from that very fact. But how do we play in this new arena? One of them, of course, is to say, okay, what is the new knowledge out there? How can we be cutting edge? A lot of countries, particularly middle-income countries on their way to development, are looking only for knowledge and tested expertise. They do not need a large-scale presence from any particular partner or donor. They're really looking for the cutting-edge expertise. When I press the button, I would like to know, what is a tested solution? How can I go for health systems reform? I'm looking at governance systems in my country. I want to introduce e-learning. I'm trying to build a knowledge-based economy. Where do I go? How can I get it? And can you assure me, guarantee? Can you give me quality? Most countries have gone from sort of the volume approach, which also was a traditional way of working in development, to quality. I want to compete in the 21st century. I want my children not just to learn to read and write. I want them to have access to internet. I want them to be active in sort of that whole space. I need to have the next batch of graduates be competitive on the labor market. And those of you who followed the Arab Spring, you know that an angry, educated youth, but with irrelevant learning and skills, is a very dangerous mix. It's not good for stability, it's destabilizing, as I mentioned, but also it is demoralizing and it is alienating citizens of a given country of what their world is, and it doesn't help shape the new generation. Now, in that, of course, we are looking to be part of South-South cooperation, take the models. We're promoting trilateral cooperation, but we're also looking to bring the role of the private sector into development. You may recall, and I say this maybe perhaps more as a European, in a certain era of development cooperation, the role of the private sector was either not necessarily embraced, it was sometimes questioned, for-profit engagement was sort of looked at maybe and frowned upon in certain circles. Nowadays, I think we've all come to recognize if you want an economy to grow, to prosper, you need jobs, you need investments, you need a predictable economic base, you need regulation, you need good governance, and you need democratic governments. Now, in that remit, of course, the UN system and UNDP has a particular role to play. But more importantly, we're also trying to encourage business to allow them to say, let's test it out. There is a reason for me to invest. Yes, I'm running a risk, but it's a calculated one. I can generate jobs, and nowadays we're looking to generate green jobs, preserve, build the economy, and I will make a profit. This is where the Growing Inclusive Markets Initiative came from, but we're also trying to partner with companies to bring them and help them bridge, because a lot of companies, they're interested, but particularly the middle ones, the medium-sized enterprises, they don't always know where to go, how to do it, and they're not quite sure if it is worth their risks or if the investment is just too high a price to pay. Multinationals can afford to do this. They've got a whole lineup of people, staff, to go through the scenarios and make sure the feasibility studies are done. but the medium-range enterprises, which are often of great interest in developing markets and in developing economies, not only in the emerging economies, but across the board in developing countries, need that extra push. This is also why we launched the Business Call to Action initiatives, which really looks at the smaller companies, take the idea, encourage one another, do peer-to-peer learning, but have one company, one entrepreneur to another say, this may be a good market to look at, go for it, we'll help you, we'll support you. And there's nothing more powerful than an entrepreneur speaking to an entrepreneur. We're the middle person. We are the go-to person because we're not in for profit. We're not a competitor. Our game is, in a way, access through development. Our best result is when a country doesn't need a UN development partner anymore, or let's say USAID. At the end of the day, we always need to have the long-term exit strategy. When development, sort of when you feel it's been achieved and the country can say, I'm becoming a full-time development provider. Like we have worked for a long time with in South Korea. In Korea, UNDP has closed its office formally in the traditional setting a few years ago. And we have opened a policy center funded by the government of Korea to really showcase what are the new development solutions and also to help showcase what Korea's successful formula was and if other countries can benefit from Korea's success. So then there are different ways in which we transform our presence. Now, the new models of public-private partnerships, and when it comes to perspectives, there are lots of opportunities that are happening. Companies certainly don't wait nowadays. They're not only actively engaged in the Global Compact, they set up new initiatives, they establish foundations, which again partner both in the economic side of development, but also in the not-for-profit side of development. And this is where we try to convene. We try to convene around ideas. We pilot projects at country level. We try to bring companies to the table. But we're also really looking at models of inclusive finance, but also using innovation that is often tested in the private sector. And I'm looking at my colleague Saba. We're about to launch with the USAID as one of the partners, the Better for Cash Alliance, which is looking at providing access to finance through using mobile telephony, having the modern technology give access to the consumer, to the client. So they're empowered. They're not waiting for the handout by the agency. They don't have to line up at the government ministry or travel 5 hours per month to collect your paycheck. You are empowered if you have access to your income, to your grant, to financial support from different partners. And it makes a huge difference. If you have to travel 5 hours on a given day to collect your paycheck, you're an absentee teacher very often or an absentee health worker. If you're not paid, the predictability of your income also makes you don't work. So the development gains of some very simple business-tested innovations are phenomenal. And this is also where we're trying to work with the private sector. And I'll round up now. We see the role of public-private partnerships, and I'm referring also to the new initiative just launched by the Secretary General on a partnership facility, the role of the private sector in public-private partnerships as significant. As I mentioned, without the private sector investing in developing countries, there is no meaningful job-rich growth. We have to emphasize the job-rich side of growth, but we also need the private sector to share its expertise, to really give us that access to the knowledge and the simple innovations very often and the fantastic business models that have been applied and tested to make them available to developing economies. And that is part of knowledge sharing, which is actually often at a low cost but can make a phenomenal difference. And a development partner such as UNDP, in that sense, again, works trilaterally. We span the public to the private, and we try to bridge and make it available and accessible. And I would stop here. Thank you.
Thank you, Sigrid. I'm going to turn the floor over to Kurt Reinsma. Kurt.
Thanks, Dan, and thank you, Sigrid. I think there's really not a whole lot I can add on the sort of new aidscape, as some people are calling it. You did a wonderful job, I think, of running over that and the new opportunities. Maybe just one takeaway number that still kind of stops me. In the 1960s, maybe up to the early 70s, there were, on average, only two or three donors in most African countries, most of the traditional sort of aid countries that we work in. Today, the average is 26, and in many countries, it's far more than that. So that gives a sense of how the world has evolved. There are, I believe, 27 DAC members, including South Korea, the last time I counted. There are another 25 countries now that have some kind of an ODA program worldwide. In many cases, they don't have an official agency per se, but they have some kind of assistance. So that's over 50 countries that are now in the aid game, again, just to give a sense of how dramatically the world has changed since I was the age of many of you in this room, starting out as a Peace Corps volunteer and all of that. So it's a very different world. I think maybe what I can add is just to give a little bit of a perspective from USAID, what we're trying to do also to respond to these changes and the new opportunities, and just give you a little bit of feel for that. I guess I would break my remarks into two categories. The first is about how we're trying to engage overall with emerging donors, and I can't cover the whole landscape, but just give a few remarks. And then the second category focuses more on private sector / emerging donors. How do we try to engage in that area? So, and by the way, emerging donors is not at all the right term. I haven't found the right term yet, but most of these countries, as I think Sigrid mentioned, don't like to be thought of as donors. They're investors, they're South-South partners, they're a whole series of things, but donors is not the right word, but I haven't yet found that perfect catchphrase for the description. So first of all, I think I just want to make it clear that this is part of an evolving relationship from the U.S. government across the board. It's not just about USAID and how our relationship is evolving with the BRICS, and again, we're using the term BRICS for shorthand. It's really the whole G20 and some others as well. But if I use the term BRICS, I don't literally mean the BRICS. I mean that group as the shorthand phrase. It really is evolving from a sort of donor-recipient relationship to a partnering relationship with these emerging investors. So there are probably two main examples of how we're trying to engage right now with that group of countries. One is the trilaterals that get a lot of attention, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. And the other is actually helping those countries where we can to develop their own overseas development assistance programs. COICA, for example, in South Korea, we have a very strong relationship that's developing all the time. We're in the process of trying to arrange a staff exchange with COICA, and I'll mention some other things we're doing with COICA a bit later. Let's go back, though, to a minute for a second to this question of these trilateral arrangements or trilateral cooperation mechanisms. First of all, why are we doing them? First, I think because they contribute to broader relationships, and again, I came up through the kind of Peace Corps track, and I sometimes have this development idealistic, purist development kind of perspective, which I'm often reminded doesn't get you so far in the real world. I think every country is doing development because it's in their own self-interest to some degree or another, whether it's a long-term enlightened self-interest or a narrower one. And that applies to the emerging economies just as it applies to the traditional donors. So it is in the broader sort of geopolitical interest to do these kinds of arrangements in many cases. There's also some real technical expertise that we can gain from the Brazils and the Indias and the Chinas, technical expertise that they have in large supply these days. We're also leveraging impact. I think we're getting greater impact both from a collaborative program and because we're working together. And then there's this whole concept of kind of international standards of good donorship. Can I use that phrase? It's perhaps a meaningless phrase, but trying to raise the international standard, the Paris principles, alignment, coordination, harmonization, host country ownership, all of those kinds of things. What are some of the lessons that are emerging from the trilateral experience? It's still very new, but there are some lessons. I think one is we need to understand up front what's driving that particular arrangement and then factor that in. Those that tend to be driven from the top down take a longer time to get traction in the third country. We have a couple of examples of ones that have taken a long time to actually get underway and get some traction on the ground. They're quite time-consuming and staff-intensive, as any relationship-based program is. It's really important to engage the, if I can call it the recipient country, you know, if it's India and the U.S. trying to work in Malawi, for example, you need to engage Malawi from the beginning. That shouldn't be the afterthought or something you add on after the arrangement is developed. And then they need to be field-driven as much as possible. We've seen the ones that are field-driven get traction. The ones that are headquarters-driven from the top tend to have trouble getting traction. And finally, I think I mentioned earlier the technical expertise, but there are some real examples of where it's easier for an emerging country to have the kinds of relevant experiences that apply to the country you're trying to work in. So then let me move on quickly to the sort of emerging economy / private sector piece of it. This gets very interesting. One of the things we're trying to do is to promote the concept or the model of public-private alliances or public-private partnerships that Sigrid mentioned. In April, we're actually going to be doing a workshop or a seminar in Seoul with COICA and involving Korean private companies on promoting the model of public-private alliances. We did one of those with JICA a couple of years back, very successful, and moving that forward. And then there are other cases where we've got specific activities where the public-private approach is being used. There's an example where we're working with Chile in Guatemala. USDA and USAID are working together with Chile in Guatemala on a public-private approach to fruit export, phytosanitary regulations, that kind of thing. Interesting example. Another area that's quite interesting is corporate social responsibility. I had the privilege a while back to chair a very interesting meeting where we partnered with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the State Department to host a group of about 20 Chinese state-owned enterprises to bring them together with U.S. companies around the topic of corporate social responsibility. And it actually really worked, believe it or not. It was quite an interesting exchange, a lot of interest on both sides. So it's another area where I think there's some interesting stuff going on. I guess that's kind of the partnering broadly at the promotion of the models sort of level. When it comes down to actual implementation on the ground, there is also some very interesting things going on. There are many examples of partnering within countries. In Indonesia, for example, there's a new partnership with an Indonesian company to promote water purification sachets. Just one of hundreds of examples, literally, of working with the private sector in the recipient country or in the emerging economy. And then in third countries, there's a few examples where this is starting to take hold. In Southern Africa, for example, we have a public-private alliance with South African-owned Standard Bank, where we're using using is maybe the wrong term. Standard Bank is providing pro bono a whole series of financial management capacity trainings and mentorings for both local government entities and for CSOs. And the reason they do that is because then they get the business from those entities who are having trouble in some cases moving donor grants through their systems because they don't have the financial management capacity. So it's an interesting case where we're partnering with a bank from a third country in other countries in Africa to strengthen financial management capacity. So again, the purpose was really just to give you a few examples and a few ideas about how we're trying to approach the whole question. I think I've probably used my time, so I'll leave it at that and take questions later. Thank you.
Thank you, Kurt. A couple things I heard was the shift in middle-income countries, or let's call them BRICS, of how the United States is thinking about we, the United States, are moving from, in essence, thinking about these as development interests to cooperation interests, and that I'm also thinking about how the UN is bumper sticker about business works for development and development works for business. A number of the examples that you cite reflect that, and I think reflect sort of this shift. So I do think what also I think is special about U.S. Bilateral donor programs, I think the U.S. has led in terms of finding new ways of building partnerships, and I think that's something that's reflected in sort of that sharing of that knowledge as well as sort of the two-way street on some of the issues that you covered. So thanks very much, Kurt. So Mr. Seok-in, thank you so much for joining us, and hope you'll share with us a little bit about the Korean experience of ODA and also the thinking about the private sector, and I'll leave it. The floor is yours, sir.
Thank you. I would like to thank you for the CSIS for inviting me to this very interesting meeting. During my intervention, I would like to share my personal observation on the development with 4 points. Number one, current situation of Korean development cooperation. Number two, very brief summary of Busan Forum, which was held last year in Seoul, in Korea. And number three, the role of the private sector in the development cooperation. Number four, some example by a Korean experience to perform the public-private partnership. Let me start with the current situation of Korean development cooperation. As you know very well, in 1950s to 60s, Korea was the poorest country in the world. So ROK has received $12.7 billion from international community from 1945 to 1999. I think that this is my personal view that we could achieve development thanks to the generous foreign aid from international community, especially United States and United Nations. Without those generous and kind aid, we could not develop economies, and we could not modernize the society as present. In 2000, we happily graduated from ODA recipient list of the ODA OECD DAC, and since then, the ROK has been transformed to a donor country. In 1987, the ROK introduced EDCF and set up a COICA, an agency for the development aid to the developing partners. And finally, we joined the OECD DAC in 2010. Actually, the year of 2010 was a turning point for the history of ODA in Korea. As I explained to you, that we joined the OECD DAC as a member in January and established an overarching legal basis to pass a framework act on international development cooperation. Also formed a comprehensive policy framework to adopt a strategic plan for international development cooperation and also adopt 2011 to 2015 midterm policy in December. Through this process, the ROK government made a clear commitment to more effective and partner-oriented aid program. As a baby member among donor countries of OECD DAC, the ROK total ODA is not big as those of major donor countries such as US, Japan, and other European countries. The size of ODA of ROK was around $1.4 billion last year, which account for 0.13 to 14% of total GNI. According to our midterm policy, we are planning to increase the ODA GNI ratio up to 0.25% in 2015. The size will be $3 billion. Over 70% of ODA are allocated for Asian and African partners. We mainly focus on building economic and social infrastructure for the developing partners. Let me move on the introduction of Busan Forum, which was held last year. The first high-level forum on aid effectiveness served as the opportunity to seek a new paradigm for international development cooperation. During the forum, the inaugural private sector forum took place on November 30th. The participating actors had the same view on the importance of business as a major development partner and agreed to hold a private sector forum to discuss concrete cooperative measures between the public and private sector. Private cooperation have become more critical as a development partner that can help secure financial resources necessary to respond to challenges such as poverty, food crisis, and climate changes, and can help find innovative answers to such problems. In the past 10 years, private enterprises have contributed to sustainable growth in developing countries through business expansion that collaborate the goal of profit making and of development. In Busan, the participating countries adopted the joint statement to increase and enhance the public-private partnership. This statement sought to acknowledge the contribution of private enterprises as an essential development partner and to improve development effectiveness through the public-private partnership. As the first joint statement in which both public and private sector agreed, this statement seeks to establish a new process for the public and private partners on development. Now I'm explaining very briefly on the view of my government on the role of private sector. The ROK thinks that the public-private partnership serves as a solid foundation for coordinated and broad-based program of trade, industrial, and human resources development by promoting innovation and enabling environment. We also see PPP as a driver for sustainable economic growth. Korea is a prime example of a country that has been able to generate and sustain rapid, resilient, and shared growth with the respective roles of the state, non-state actors, and making shifting over time. Korea has made a success by developing its comparative advantage and moving up value chains in the global markets through joint efforts between the government and the private sector. The government shared the investment risk of the private sector, improved regulation, liberalized market entry, and provided support largely based on performance in competitive global markets while minimizing negative government externalities such as corruption. Recently, in Korea, the global CSR partnership program is getting more and more popular in the various enterprises as well as in the society as a whole. Corporate social responsibility, Federal of Korean Industries, FKI, which is the Association of Korean Big Conglomerates, has organized a fair for CRS partnership every year under the slogan of a brighter future since 2009. At the fair, NGO proposed some project, then NGO and conglomerates made a decision what project to be implemented domestically as well as globally. This is a good example for private-private partnership on the development cooperation. COICA, the governmental agency, is currently conducting more than 10 projects with the cooperation of various Korean enterprises under the framework of public-private partnership in Asia, Africa, and Central Asia. For example, Asiana, one of the major airline companies in Korea, is implementing a project in China and the Philippines. Asiana's slogan is One Company, One Village, or One Company, One School Movement. It offers assistance to the school in China and gives the village people foundation to live independently in Philippines. Hyundai Motors set up an auto tech education center for the purpose of the capacity building of youth in Ghana. This project have been implemented under the close consultation and cooperation with COICA. That is all that I prepared for today's meeting. I'm not sure I deliver my message to you smoothly. To be frank with you, I'm not well aware of the issue on the development cooperation. Rather, I'm specialist on the security issue on the Korean Peninsula. However, because of today's opportunity...
Maybe we can have a public-private partnership to solve the challenge of the Korean Peninsula. But I understand that this is part of your new part of your portfolio.
Yes.
So I think we've done you a service in helping you get briefed up
on
it beforehand.
Thank you. Right. Because of today's opportunity, I had a valuable chance to deepen my understanding.
That's right.
On the issue. I realized that development issue has a noble cause.
Okay.
And it's important agenda for a bright future for everybody.
Thank you, Mr.
In this sense, thank you for CSIS.
Thank you so much. Thank you. But I'm looking forward to that public-private partnership we're going to be implementing Pyongyang in a few years. So thank you. When we get peace in the peninsula, so thank you. Let me take advantage of some of the comments of Mr. Siakon and Kurt to take advantage of Sigrid's presence to ask her about a couple specific things that she touched on, but I want to just push a little bit further on, and then we'll open up to the broader audience. Sigrid, you talked about the fact that Turkey has opened up this new office. I think this is particularly interesting, partially because it reflects the fact that you all have done some incredible thought leadership through the Growing Inclusive Markets Initiative, but... and also some of the work that you're doing on the ground and also sort of the broader development issues. But could you just talk a little bit further about what prompted Turkey to do this and also what are some of the expectations that you have for that program going forward? And the second is, okay, Kurt mentioned the fact that there are folks that kind of grew up in a traditional development mindset. I suspect there are folks in UNDP that have a traditional development mindset that would say, maybe this is just a fad, and this is sort of the flavor of the week, and I'll just wait until Helen Clark leaves office, or I'll wait out Sigrid, and maybe she'll leave, and we'll wait out Saba, and he'll retire, and that we'll wait all this stuff out because this is all just one big fad, and I don't really want to do this. I didn't grow up in the development community to do this kind of stuff, and some of these folks may be res reps, maybe the heads of your country offices. So how are you dealing with, let's call it, cultural change or organizational change? So two unrelated topics, but I think two critical questions, I think, there for you. So, Sigrid, the floor.
Thank you very much. I'll start with the last one because it's something very close to my heart. Maybe because I have changed different entities. I've worked in the private sector, public sector, national government, different UN organizations. So you always realize as you change entities yourselves, often colleagues are convinced wherever they worked in the same place for too long and the same issue that this is so unique and nobody else can understand it. And my premise always has been, unless you work for NASA probably or you have a highly developed skill set, but in our field it's what you acquire. And to some extent you sometimes de-skill after you leave university. This is a sobering note for those of you who are still at it. But in terms of the cultural change, the behavior change, I think it's always important. Obviously, we say we remain abreast and we do something with the information and the change, that we're part of change. But as human beings, we're probably by nature quite conservative. And the more we are corporately organized, the more entrenched our conservatism becomes. I'm obviously not talking political parties here. I'm just talking behavior. And with that, you always have to keep challenging yourself. One way of doing it, and UNDP is doing it, is bringing many more people in from the outside. It's not just speaker series and recruiting other staff, but realizing, and I think the reality check has hit everybody in the international development system, but I would also say in diplomacy, there's so many pieces of the puzzle. I mean, I think WikiLeaks, for instance, has shown that the power of secrecy or confidentiality is easily torn down. The internet has revolutionized. The fact that you can basically sell a development idea on eBay, you can go and fundraise for something, you never have to go, you never have to leave your village, your town, you can be part of this global community. So I think that has a big revolutionizing impact, slowly but surely, and we have to be part of it. Now, the corporate change and the behavioral change, I think, is one of leadership, definitely Helen Clark, definitely also the people she recruits and retains. And then, of course, you need to build that incentive culture that we spoke about also earlier on when we had a private chat. So you reward also success. You look for success. You look to reward those who embrace risk, calculated risk. Have you tested a pilot? Has it been interesting, but documented, get it out? What we often find in large organizations, people sit not only on a wealth of information, but they're often quite reluctant, or they're working so much in their own bubble, they forget it may actually have meaning to others. So we need to be more networked, and we're all building that, but then use the networks and share it, and don't feel we have to, in a way, recognize failure as much, unless it's an audit and a financial compliance issue. But failure in programming, testing out ideas, has to be rewarded as much as you reward success. Because very often what you find in organizations, and same in politics, it seems, that everything is a success. Well, if everything was a success, clearly we didn't learn anything. That's one. Secondly, is actually you're not talking about the real experiences you've gone through. And development partners, and I think they are also pushing us the most, the program countries, the partner countries, they know so well what they want. We, thank God, empowerment has reached levels that we don't need to come and say, oh, we found it for you and let us try it out. So I think the top-down that you mentioned, Kurt, I think has long gone, fortunately. I think definitely we know, and program countries know, they're in the driver's seat. And don't come and tell me otherwise. UN res reps, for instance, don't get an agrément, don't get accreditation if they don't fit the profile that the government wants. If you don't match the skill set they're looking for at that point in time. Same with programs. We do have national development strategies going forward, which are country-owned. And that's extremely important. We need to make sure we can fit in. Now, when you look at sort of the talk again about innovation, countries are also very specific nowadays, what they ask of all of us, I think. Maybe when you come still with volume and scale, and there are, as a member state, it's different. You have your relationship with a country is very complex. From a development perspective, it's also complex, but it's much more on the demand side. Countries ask us and say, we want this, and we don't want that, and we want this type of expertise. Can you look for it? Can you help us procure it? And Turkey, I think, that to segue into Turkey, is one such example. Turkey's phenomenal economic success has been very critical. The country's current government firmly believes in investing in the private sector. And as Kurt said, Turkey obviously is also looking to consolidate its bases within the region, but beyond. It's looking west and it's looking east. And east is its natural home. Now, companies are often of a medium-sized nature in Turkey so far. Their natural market is in the vicinity, at the moment not very stable, but if peace and security does sort of come back, there's a huge export potential. And I'll tell you, I used to live in the Middle East for a long time. In Jordan, all clothes have always been from Turkey. Food supplies are from Turkey. Same, obviously, until recently in Syria, same in other parts of the Middle East, same in North Africa. A huge, huge natural export market with a cultural affinity because the products that are being exported from Turkey, even the clothing, are sort of in tune with what the population within the region wants. So it's huge. Turkey then, however, said, we want to be a player too. Let's explore. Let's have a center for the private sector in development. Not the private sector on development or the private sector for development, the private sector in development. Doing two things. One of them is build the capacity of Turkish private sector companies, how they can build up and scale up and enhance their capacity to do better business and also explore European markets. But secondly, also teach what private sector can do for developing countries, a lot of them in the vicinity, but elsewhere too. So they're bridging the development and investment pathway in a way to benefit Turkey and to benefit the developing markets. It's a huge win-win. And again, here we convene. Coming back to your point, are we willing enough to change? I like to think so. But at the end of the day, it is the real world out there that fortunately forces all of us to change. We may at a certain age, we may be past the maturity point. I don't know. I like to think not, but
nobody,
you know,
on this panel, at least.
Oh, I know. I was looking at myself. But there is always a healthy check, and you always need to make sure you stay connected. You bring in young talent, you be challenged by young talent, and by becoming a horizontally organized organization, an entity, you can actually make sure that the best ideas reach you straight away, because that's, I think, also the internal reflection that we need.
Thanks, Sigrid. I'm going to open up the floor. I know there are a number of thoughtful people here in the room. I've got my colleague here who's going to bring the microphone. I'd ask you to identify yourself and respectfully ask that you frame it in the form of a brief question, as opposed to a long monologue or something that's sort of way out there, right? So I'm going to start with this gentleman over here. And why don't we group a couple questions together? We'll do this World Bank style so that we can capture several questions. And if anything's a little too loopy, it'll give a chance for the speakers to think about it and then give a more thoughtful answer. So go ahead, and then we'll bunch questions together.
It's not so much a question. I just first got to thank my son for reminding me of this meeting, because I was a UN delegate for about 11 years ago when we were talking about public-private partnerships and alliances, and everybody thought we were coming out from Mars somewhere. But let's talk about helping small and medium-sized business. And this has been a very refreshing evening for me. I'm in the process now. Young lady wants to start an international training center in Kenya. All right? And part of that is to look at that whole concept of taking women leadership in Kenya and moving them into the process of dealing with the current business they have for the local economy, and then hopefully impact what will go on, you know, in the larger economy. And this has been refreshing. This has been a lot. This is 11 years.
Good.
You know, and it's absolutely, I'm supposed to be retired, but I think I'll come out now.
Oh, good.
Okay.
All right, so let's get the woman up here and then the woman over here.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Mariko Schmitz. I'm a program officer with JICA. Thank you very much for the shout out. I have been following the post-MDG discussion around here and also in Europe, and I've spoken to some people in NGOs and think tanks and bilaterals and multilaterals, and I think the framework is starting to develop, but the one group that I haven't heard from and I haven't read anything from is the private sector. When do you think, is the private sector mobilizing, and if not, when will they start to think about this? Are they going to think about this? And are they going to participate in Rio? Thank you.
The woman behind, over here.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Rosemary Seguero. I'm the president of Seguero's International Group. Thank you so much, Singrid, for the wonderful information, and Ms. Tong, the presentation was wonderful and very informative. While I look at your information, Ingrid, you talked about the missing middle. I happened to write a concept on the missing middle at the World Bank, to do with banking at the World Bank. And what you talked, more of the missing middles, entrepreneurs and banks have left small entrepreneurs behind. So I'll share, I would like to have your business card to share with you my missing middle concept. And Mr. Kong, looking at Korea, how do you involve women, or how are women involved into development or entrepreneurship and leadership in Korea? And as a businesswoman, as a woman owned business from the US and Africa, to I come from Kenya, what would you import from the USA, and what would you import from Africa? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'm gonna just put my friend Mr. Sullivan on the spot from SIPE, who's back there. John, I just know that you're here, and given that what you do at SIPE is particularly interesting, it'd be useful if you just make just a brief comment on what you've heard today about the UN, and also just provide in the context of your day job.
Well, thank you very much, Dan. John Sullivan with the Center for International Private Enterprise, an affiliate of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, as is the Business Civic Leadership Center, which is here somewhere, and was mentioned. I guess one of the things I would comment on, having been at Busan, I really enjoyed the private sector forum. And I would underline, the head of the BIAC, the Business Industry Advisory Committee, went out of his way and was one of the few, along with Georg Kell, the head of the UN Global Compact, to bring up and put out on the table what I think is the central issue that is still not receiving the attention that it needs, and that is the business-enabling environment. I would note that it receives a lot of prominence in your report here on growing inclusive markets. What I would also note, though, is it's one of those subjects that is talked about at the presidential level, no matter what country you're in, but doesn't translate down much. And if we don't solve that problem, what we're going to see is public-private partnerships in Brazil, not public-private partnerships in Uganda. Because if you don't get the enabling environment that's going to attract the foreign direct investment, that's going to nurture the private sector entrepreneurs in the country, and most importantly, as my friend Hernando de Soto says, we have still not addressed the problem of informality. As long as in so many countries around the world, the majority of the entrepreneurs are locked out of the formal economy in the informal sector, we can't claim to be addressing inclusive markets. We've got to break that issue, and that's going to require governments. And I do accept the fact that the India and China signed the Busan Declaration, but I would note that part of the negotiation was that they insisted on it being only applying to South-South principles, and they also insisted that it be voluntary, whereas the rest of the participants signed a mandatory binding North-South declaration. I would note in that context, Brazil stepped forward, and I was very, very pleased to see them do that. So we're moving in the right direction. I'm just not sure. Maybe you can comment on how could we accelerate the pace and how can we put the enabling environment back in the center of the dialogue?
I'm going to use these four to we'll capture these four, and we'll, if we have a chance, we'll do another round. But thank you, John, for that. Let me jump in on this issue, and then I'll let the rest of the panelists respond to whatever questions that they want to, because this is a topic near and dear to my heart. I'm fearful that there are political constituencies for lots of the foreign assistance budget, but there's not really a political constituency for economic growth or for democracy and governance. There's not an earmark for either one of those. And the sweetest money in the aid system is development assistance, economic growth money. It's really hard to find. And so my fear is that when it comes down, yes, we sign lots of declarations, but when the real moment of people, time, and money is applied in a lot of development agencies, or at least I'll speak to the American context, we have situations where we're having to. There's certainly mental agreement and belief that this is important, but either because of what comes from the Congress or what comes out of that sausage making process doesn't reflect the importance that it deserves. So that's my editorial comment on your observation. So thank you. I'm now going to open it up. Yes, absolutely. Well, we can start the economic growth lobbying group afterwards. Not here at CSIS because we're not neutral here, but we can do that off campus. But let me ask the panelists to react to the comments and questions that you heard from this group. Please take them in any order.
I'll just take them in order of arrival. I just wanted to commend you for your comment on the role of women. You talked about the training center, but also really the role of women and leadership in the private sector. I think women-headed households, female-headed households, key. Women look after education, health. We know an educated woman and immediately enhances the socioeconomic status of her family. So I think we need to make sure that the women entrepreneurs are certainly supported if we have to go for sort of affirmative action of any kind, and we can do so in our programming. Post-MDG framework, yes, there is a lot of talk, but not a lot of definitions yet. There's a growing consensus that we need to retain a framework because it has proven to mobilize and galvanize and make sure that we're actually measuring development results in some meaningful form. However, Rio, because it's still so political, the talk of sustainable development goals is quite complicated, it's tough, and there's only a process starting now in different fora to start to see how we can bring the thought leadership on post-2015 in line with some of the discussions on the potential of formulating some MDGs, but the themes are yet to be confirmed. We know that access to energy is a critical issue. We know we need to deal with burgeoning cities and. We also need to know, we need to look at youth one way or another. But whether it's an SDG, whether it will become an MDG, is very much a technical and a political debate. Your question was also, is the private sector being mobilized? I'm not quite sure if we need to mobilize the private sector in this way, but we do need to use the private sector's perspective and insights on, indeed, the economy, but also employment. We have job pacts. The ILO has been leading. We're looking at inclusive growth, job-rich growth, green jobs, as nowadays is also the terminology. So we need to have their perspectives. Whether they need to be mobilized, there's the World Business Council in Geneva. There are lots of companies that are part through the Global Compact that are thinking. But if I were an entrepreneur as well, I wouldn't be so worried if I want to be part of certainly formalizing the MDGs. I'm more interested to make sure that actually MDGs come out that are actually workable for me when it also comes for in making the right investments. And they are at Rio, big time, in different panels, in different fora. They are speakers, they're on high-level events, so they're absolutely there. But I think that the private sector will be included in a number of consultations, same as civil society. I didn't hear anybody mention civil society, but civil society used to have strong views also on the role of the private sector. But again, civil society is now saying, where is the private sector? This is a new global compact around development cooperation. And that is really also what the Busan outcome document has brought us. I was one of the Sherpas of the outcome document, and I may want to differ a little bit with the interpretation of the voluntary signing off. But that comes back then to the missing middle. We do need to look indeed at the tendency, when you look at Global Compact and others, the tendency is to look only at the big players globally, but they will find their way. What is really important is that they're prepared to be champions and advocates and set standards, that they are prepared to promote and propose and really be normative also in their own regulation when they make investment choices, moving way beyond corporate social responsibility. Corporate social responsibility, in a way, was the business side of philanthropy, but with an economic touch. Now we're really looking at hardcore investments which have development spin-offs, and that's a very different slant. Corporate social responsibility always remains important, but it was a starting point for that dialogue with the private sector. Now, as to your question in terms of the enabling environment, it's the critical one, of course. I actually think here organizations such as UNDP have a fantastic and a phenomenal lead role to play, because we work on governance, because we're looking at poverty reduction, and in governance we're looking at rule of law, the legislative reform, we're looking at training, we're looking at capacity building. That is all part of the puzzle of the enabling environment. But the enabling environment, of course, is also tariff walls, it's trade regulation, it is corruption. And that is, I think, the most endemic and the hardest one. It's transparency. It is capability within government and non-government. It is also access for the private sector. As you know, as a private sector in a number of highly undemocratic states, there were phenomenal business opportunities in most of the countries that are now in the Arab Spring, but they were on the wrong side and they excluded everybody else. So also it's about ethics in business. And there's also that, I think, the other side is, how does business regulate itself in terms of partnering with whom? Yes, certain government counterparts in certain regimes give you access and your investments are protected. There is the enabling environment, but it probably wouldn't have been ethical if one looks back. So I think that's a judgment call that we can both sort of debate on together, and I think the Global Compact here is very, very helpful. But the endemic face of corruption in most countries, I think, is still the toughest nut to crack. But UNDP is very strong on its overall governance program. And indeed, as you said, there is no earmarked funding per se for governance. It doesn't sell very well. It doesn't sell particularly well in most countries, I think, not just here, but in Europe. But here is where you come to actually, if I make a pitch here, you come to finance the core budget of an organization. If you know you believe in its value and its contribution to such critical issues, that shouldn't need an earmark, but it needs sufficient financial capacity to allow the organization to deliver its mandate, the same as this country, for instance, is a significant shareholder in the World Bank. So there also, I think, we would need help to make sure that is retained. Now, the informality, the informal sector and the informality, you're absolutely right. But I think in this transition phases, in a lot of developing countries, we have to make sure we retain the opportunities the informal sector gives the starters. But it needs to be structured in a way that one can come out of the informal sector and really become big and have access to finance. But a lot of the debate on inclusive finance is also really giving opportunities to the informal sector. And I think we want to move away from it, and it probably needs a transition period and it needs channeling. But we shouldn't undermine the tremendous potential for a lot of the poor, that the informal sector is their first step out of poverty. So one way or another, I think we need to balance that out.
Kurt, comments on what you heard?
Yeah, I'll be very brief. Just maybe two comments, one on the sort of private sector mobilization and one on the enabling environment. I think the whole mobilization question, it's not that the private sector isn't mobilized. The private sector is way ahead of us. I mean, they get the, you know, global integrated world stuff long before we got it, and that's all definitely happening at speed. There's a question, I think, of who speaks for the private sector and whose private sector we're talking about. And there is obviously some political sensitivities, and particularly in this budget environment, with regard to whose private sector is being promoted here. But I think that it's more a question of not. It's not that they aren't mobilized. It's which grouping or which sort of umbrella mechanism you want to deal with. On the enabling environment, Dan is absolutely right that kind of money to promote economic growth as a sector is quite scarce. However, there's a lot happening on that within other sectors. Agriculture and food security, for example, a lot of what the administration's new Feed the Future approach is on is encouraging private sector in agriculture, in Africa in particular. And you're going to be hearing a lot more about that, by the way, in the next 6 months. And there's some very interesting work being done to try to really address those enabling environment questions. It's still a big, it's still a heavy lift. There's a long ways to go. I agree with everything that you all said about the blockages with regard to the enabling environment, including corruption. That's only one. I remember at one point in time, one of my South Korean colleagues told me that South Korea was simultaneously the fastest growing economy in the world and the most corrupt economy in the world. So that always made me wonder about this relationship between corruption and growth. But no, you didn't, but a South Korean told me that about 20 years ago. So nonetheless, there's a lot being done on the enabling environment, which is sort of hidden within sectoral approaches. Agriculture is a good example of that. Even in the health sector, there's some interesting stuff going on systemic enabling environment issues.
No, I do agree with that. I also think aid doesn't get the credit it deserves on being the primary funder for 30 years of Hernando de Soto's work. It funded 90% of its work for 30 years. It got it basically a straight-up earmark, and people love Hernando de Soto, and it was brought to you by USAID. And I agree, Kurt, that a lot of it's a sort of almost a cross-cutting issue in some of the sectors. But we can organize the economic growth earmark lobby off campus, and I hope you'll be available at 4:30 for the first meeting. But Mr. Sergio Ong, maybe you could just speak to the issue of Busan. We talked a little bit further about Busan. Would you have any comments about Busan from what you heard, or anything else you wanted to add about Busan? I know that Sigrid also had some comments about Busan, but I thought I'd take advantage of your presence to make any additional comments on Busan.
Can I first clarify some points on the women's role?
Yes, absolutely.
In Korea.
Yes, absolutely. As they have to do with the peninsula and the security aspect of it, or no? Just wanted to clarify that. Just kidding.
I need to say a lot on the role of ladies in Korea, because in the past, yes, true that the women have contributed a lot to developing economies and the society until now. But in the past, the status of women in South Korea was terrible. And then they did not get paid compared to the men who occupied the same job. So, and then currently we have 300 lawmakers, but unfortunately we have only one tenth. Around 30 women's lawmakers. So the ratio is very, very low compared to the Western countries, especially the European countries. But the trend sinks very rapidly and very, very fast. So nowadays, the women's status is going up and up very rapidly. So nowadays,
Like there's been significant progress mm-hmm. made in your country. Mm-hmm. I mean, on so many levels. I was saying to Sigrid earlier that South Korea and Ghana were at the same economic development level in 1960, and now you're the host of the mm-hmm. of the Busan conference. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, there's certainly been progress on any number of different fronts in South Korea, of course, including in gender mm-hmm. equity as well. But perhaps you could talk a little bit about, make some other comments about Busan.
Busan. Can you give me some minutes?
I'm hoping it's not too much longer on gender equity, but I think you, because it's a very important topic. Uh-huh. But perhaps we could talk about Busan. Okay, yeah. Sigrid, you could say something about Busan.
Uh, the observation on Busan that I'll explain in two minutes.
Yep.
Yeah. I need to...
I didn't want to take your space.
Mm, thank you.
On Busan, I think... As Mr. So has already mentioned, it was a phenomenal success, Busan, in some ways. There are always critics, and we can all look at the outcome document and say what wasn't in there or what was perceived by some constituencies as being watered down. The importance of Busan, however, is the first time that all the development providers, private sector and civil society, private sector was not in Accra, civil society was, private sector, civil society, and the new development partners, the Brazils, the Chinas, the Indias, they were all there. They were negotiating the document, and yes, they were distancing themselves, as all other providers of the South, from the outcome document. They did not sign up to Paris and Accra commitments. Those who've committed to Paris and Accra remain committed, but that didn't get restated in a way. So you see differentiated responsibilities, a strong emphasis on South-South cooperation. It's a voluntary document. There is no normative nature. It's not a convention anybody signed up on. So the beauty of it is, and the challenge, of course, is that everybody has Busan now as a set of guiding principles and informing them or inspiring them. But you can take away from it what you want to take away from it. And that is also why other countries were allowed to join. It was a breakthrough because none of these countries were signing up to Paris and Accra. And this sets out a new stage for dialogue. It's inclusive. It recognizes the contribution by others over the years. And it also spells out very clearly how we want to keep on moving. The partner countries, it was very clear to me in the negotiations as well, both for Africa as well as a group of G7 plus represented by Timor-Leste on fragile states, and what is called the New Deal on peace building and peace building implementation. They're all quite clear as to feeling empowered by the Busan outcome documents, because they can say to any development provider, you are at Busan, this is how we see the situation. This is now what we expect in terms of behavior, in terms of your support, what we will bring, national ownership, capacity development. The voice of the South was very, very clear, and I think that's a phenomenal breakthrough. Korea can only be complimented for its vision and leadership, and also really having very skillfully negotiated the outcome document. There were a lot of trips made, particularly by my fellow Sherpa, Ms. Anna Parks, to China, to other countries, and really skillfully getting the negotiations through. The question now is, what are we going to do in the post-Busan era? And there's now a group, just to not bore you with process, but it's quite important, that is really trying to give meaning to the global partnership, which is mentioned in the outcome document, i.e., how do we make sure that we keep up this policy dialogue? How do we give meaning to this brave new world out there of development cooperation opportunities? And I liked your term when you said we're sort of moving from aid to development cooperation. So it's really that...
Cooperation interests
that are really out there. And how do we galvanize that? And how do we leverage that for impact? But we've got to remain clear, and that's where the post-MDG framework comes in. We've got to be clear we set the goals in the right way and that we measure them. And this is where commitments can come in.
And before Mr. Sergong, I'm going to give you the last word. One of the things that we've been doing some work here at CSIS on middle-income countries, and yeah. I, like Kurt, I'm struggling for how to talk about this. But the way we're talking about this at CSIS is saying the way in which the United States and other donors think about middle-income countries as we shift from a set of development interests to a set of cooperation interests, it needs to track the evolution of, at least in my mind, how we cooperate with Korea. That South Korea has been sort of, we point to Korea as an example of, here's a country that was a donor recipient, as Mr. Sayarkon said, and then has shifted to a very sophisticated donor where it's building private partnerships with its companies on the ground, it's hosting Busan. And so we see other developing countries as having moving in that direction. And so I think that it's been a – and I think it's interesting that countries like Brazil or India are saying, look, it's interesting, we want to learn from the experience of other donor countries and the experience of others, but we actually think – We're not going to necessarily follow that route, and so I think it was particularly important that South Korea, as a recent DAC member, and as a recent donor country, hosted Busan because it provided sort of a halfway house, if you will, from sort of traditional donors to sort of bridging to other emerging donors. I know that's not the right elegant expression for it. So, Mr. Sergon, I'm going to give you the last word about Busan, and then we'll end the panel. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Busan was very successful. We evaluate because the Busan has adopted a Busan Partnership for Effective Development Cooperation. And we also start a new global development cooperation to include all development actors, such as the not only existing the donor countries, but also emerging donors, as well as the private sectors. So, and also we adopted the political statement. The political statement gives the Busan, the result of the Busan Forum, to the political support from the each country.
Thank you very much. I'm very grateful. I'm particularly grateful for Mr. Serkan, who was a good sport in coming to speak at this panel. I'm very grateful to you. And I'm also very appreciative of Kurt Reinsma for taking time out of his busy schedule to do this. Thank you very much, Kurt. And Sigrid, thanks for coming down from New York. I think we're going to have to end the panel here now, but so please join me in thanking the panel, and thank you very much.